Today we're live from the old state capitol, which was home to our state government during the Civil War, and to Abraham Lincoln's famous A House Divided speech. Plus, in today's state politics, the former legislative inspector general says the process for holding lawmakers accountable is broken. We'll talk about why. And in 1994, five living presidents gathered for Richard Nixon's funeral. A Springfield production of the play Five Presidents imagines what that meeting was like 25 years ago.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and today we're coming to you live from Representatives Hall in the Old State Capitol in Springfield. And as you can hear, we've got a great audience that's here with us today as we're helping our friends at NPR Illinois kick off their Public Radio Week. There's everything from a podcast workshop to storytelling to live music, so if you're in the Springfield area, you can get your tickets to that at nprillinois.org. If you're a regular listener to the 21st, you know that every year we take a trip to the current state capitol for the governor's budget address. We've gotten pretty familiar with that building now, but this is our first time in the old state capitol, which was the seat of Illinois government from 1840 to 1876. A lot has happened here. In fact, we are in the very room where a lawyer and former congressman named Abraham Lincoln was running for the U.S. Senate and delivered his famous speech where he said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." And just outside this building, nearly 150 years later, a young senator named Barack Obama launched his campaign for president. Lots of history here, so we thought we would start by learning a little bit more about this building and its place in Illinois history. And for that, I'm here with Troy Gilmore. He's Assistant Site Superintendent for Springfield State Historic Sites, which includes the Old State Capitol. Troy, welcome to the 21st, and thank you for hosting us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
So I mentioned the speech that, well, not he wasn't President Lincoln. He was Representative Lincoln then, delivered in this room. But before we get to that, I wonder if you can just tell us about Representatives Hall, what this room was used for.
Sure. So we are in the place where the representatives would have met, and Abraham Lincoln, being a representative in 1840 and 41, serving his fourth and final term as a representative, but his first term in this building. Keep in mind, this building was only built in 1837, so prior to this, Lincoln served as a representative in Vandalia, the state house that was there.
Because that's when the state capitol was in Vandalia.
Correct, yes. So the state being established in 1818, the territorial capital was in Kaskaskia, very far southern Illinois, Cape Girardeau, Missouri. If you think that far south, that's where the state capitol was at, the territorial capital for a year, then moving to Vandalia, and then by 1840, once this building complete, comes to Springfield.
And I think we were talking about this before the show. It's always an interesting historical footnote that the state capitol ends up here in Springfield as opposed to, say, Chicago. Can you remind us the size of Springfield when the state capitol was first created here?
Sure. When this building was being built, there was about 1,500 people that lived in Springfield. Now, people think that why is the capitol not in Chicago? Because that's the largest city in Illinois. Well, at that time, there was only about 500 people who lived on a little outpost along Lake Michigan called Chicago. So it has really nothing to do with size, but all with a central location. And Abraham Lincoln was instrumental in getting the state capitol brought to Springfield. There were lots of other towns all along today, Interstate 72, that were vying for this position, places like Decatur or Jacksonville wanting this. Even Alton was one of the locations that was considered, but finally Springfield becoming the state capitol building.
And so when we're thinking about this particular building that we're in, our audience is actually sitting in the actual desks, and it looks a lot like when if people have seen pictures of our nation's capitol. It's kind of a desk where these are the desks where the actual lawmakers sat.
That's right. And what's the most unusual about this room is that there were not assigned seats during that time period. So today, go to the current state capitol, each and every legislator has his or her own desk, And if they are not sitting there, then nobody else gets to sit there. Well, in 1840, it wasn't the case. You had the Democrats who sat on the left-hand side of the aisle. The Whigs, later to become the Republicans, sit on the right. And Lincoln, a creature of habit, many times sat the second row back, the third seat in. And so that's actually where we have our top hat at today. And yes, sir, you get the prize today.
So you were sitting, that's right, you were, and the quills and candles were how everyone, that was the light in the writing utensils, I presume?
The paper actually reports by 1858, when Lincoln gives his House Divided speech here on the middle of June, 1858 at night, when he stands up, they say that Lincoln takes the stage by the glow of the gas lights. So we know that gas lighting actually was here in this building by the mid-1850s. But today we've got candles and some lamps that burn whale oil that are about, and that would have been the lighting of the time period.
I'm here with Troy Gilmore, and we're inside Representatives Hall at the old state capitol. Troy, what kind of things were state lawmakers talking about during this time? Obviously, Lincoln's House Divided speech gives us a sense of how much the run-up to the Civil War, there were conversations about the country and the direction of the country.
That's right. And if you think about even Lincoln's career, even by the election in 1860, you know that civil war will take place. It doesn't take until the middle of April when those first shots are fired on Fort Sumter when we know that the civil war really started. Even in the election leading up to 1860, Lincoln knew that if elected, he was going to have a tumultuous time in the White House at that time. But even in 1858, Lincoln is in this building. He puts the finishing touches on his House Divided speech that he was to give here in this room, in the room down below us, which was the state library. And in Herndon's biography, he even says that a lot of his friends gathered around in the state library before Lincoln was to give that speech. And his friends weren't really too impressed with the things that Lincoln was about to say, because it was not the popular, no pun intended, idea of the time period, because popular sovereignty was really more of the way in which most of the politics were going in our nation. Let the people decide. Put that out to the voters, and we'll see if there should be slavery. However, Lincoln outlines this idea in the House Divided speech that we should all be free. And I love the first line of Lincoln's House Divided speech. I'll paraphrase it and basically saying that Lincoln says we need to look at first where we have been, where we currently are, in order to determine where we need to go. And I think that that's still definitely relatively applicable today, but we take a look at what Lincoln did, and he was assessing the political climate, and the institution of slavery was an antiquated thing, and he knew moving forward that it needed to be abolished.
So you have a personal connection to this history. Your great-great-grandfather, is that correct, fought with the 53rd Illinois Volunteer Infantry from Ottawa?
That's correct.
In the Civil War?
Yes, and I do Civil War reenacting as a hobby even today. And for me, this is not just a job, but this is personal. The history goes back a long ways, and my great-great-grandfather from Ottawa was with Sherman on his march to the sea, and his promotional papers in 1864 to captain and then to lieutenant were signed in this building. My office is housed here in this building as well, and they hang on my wall today in my office. But they were signed by the governor, by Governor Yates of the time period, by Secretary Hatch, and by Adjutant General Allen in this building. And so you just, for me, it's the personal relationship that I have not only with this structure, but with history in general, that makes me absolutely love my job.
Troy, thanks for sharing that with us. I wonder, and we've been talking about this room, there's so much else on this floor. Is there anything else you want to point out just to our audience that's listening throughout the whole state about other historical items of importance that are in this building?
Well, keep in mind when this building was being built, today it's not a very large building. But when it was built, it was the biggest building in Illinois. And it was using locally sourced materials that this building was built. And so this building really just kind of rose from the ground up here in 1837, only utilized for 36 years. By 1868, they've already outgrown this building, and they've started breaking ground on the new and current state capitol 5 blocks away from here. But this building, really an important part of our state and our nation's history, when you think about those formidable years, not only for folks like Abraham Lincoln, but lots of people that would have been impacted by the early politics as Springfield being the state capital.
That's Troy Gilmore, Assistant Site Superintendent for Springfield's State Historic Sites, one of which the Old State Capitol. Troy, thank you so much for coming on the program and for hosting us here today.
You're so welcome. Thanks for being here.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this morning we're live from the Old State Capitol. And as Troy mentioned, the current State Capitol is barely a mile from where we're sitting. State politics are a little different now from than they were in the 19th century, and we do like to normally start our Mondays on The 21st with a look at state politics. And so it's appropriate that joining us now is Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey. Hey, Brian, good morning.
Hey, Nyla, how are you?
Good. So I wanted to focus on a story that you wrote last week that I'm guessing people may not have noticed as much with lots of other news that was breaking last week. And that's in regards to the legislative inspector general. And let's just start with the headline of your story from last week. What's going on with that office?
Well, the former legislative inspector general, who was in there temporarily, and we can talk about why it was a temporary post, she basically says the office is broken. And that it needs major overhauls if it's not going to be completely powerless.
And when she says that, I mean, that's a pretty bold statement.
Yeah. So, and maybe we need to back up a little bit and talk about what the Office of Legislative Inspector General does. This is the person that is charged with looking into allegations of wrongdoing against members of the General Assembly. They take all kinds of complaints. It can be anything from, I saw a car with General Assembly license plates speeding down the interstate, all the way up to, I was sexually harassed by a lawmaker when I was, you know, trying to present them with a legislative idea.
Mm-hmm. And so they also work with the Legislative Ethics Commission, which is made up of lawmakers. And what are they supposed to do?
Yeah, to say they work with them is maybe overstating it. They really work for them, at their pleasure, and completely at their control. And that's one of the issues that Julie Porter, this woman who is had been the legislative inspector general, identified. She is a former federal prosecutor, by all accounts, a tough, fair-minded investigator. And she says there are three big problems. One, she has to get the Legislative Ethics Commission's permission to open a case. She has to have their permission to subpoena witnesses. And she has to have their permission to publish any findings that she comes up with, any case that she feels is founded. The Legislative Ethics Commission, you asked about, that is a group of eight lawmakers. It's perfectly bipartisan, even though the legislature is not. It's also bicameral. So there's two Democrats from the House, two Democrats from the Senate, two Republicans from the House, two Republicans from the Senate, and they have total say over what is made public in terms of complaints that are filed.
So just correct me if I'm wrong here. This is the Legislative Inspector General, so they are investigating lawmakers, but it sounds like they don't have the independence to pursue investigations without permission from lawmakers.
That is what Julie Porter, the outgoing Legislative Inspector General, says, is that without that permission, the office is basically powerless, that she cannot do the job she was appointed to do. And she says her successor, who's a woman named Carol Pope, a former appellate judge here in central Illinois, again, highly regarded, but she says that she, too, will be hamstrung in trying to do her job because everything flows through the lawmakers who, have a vested interest in perhaps keeping things quiet.
Okay, so she says the office is broken. Do we know what she was investigating?
Well, we know very little. So there were, and maybe we should back up even further, this office sat vacant for 3 years, right? This is a job it had been. It was created in the early aughts after George Ryan's scandals and a number of other scandals in Illinois. It was occupied for about 10 years by a guy named Tom Homer, former legislator, former judge himself. And on his way out, he too said the office had a lot of problems and needed to be changed. That was in 2014. And the office basically sat vacant for 3 years when the Me Too harassment movement.
And which certainly was no, I mean, there were lots of stories here within the state capitol. We've seen ramifications of lawmakers who have lost positions because of allegations.
Well, I would say we've seen a ramification in terms of there was one lawmaker who is no longer a lawmaker specifically because of a complaint that went through the Legislative Inspector General's
office. I was thinking
of
staffers too, but yes.
Yeah, okay. There have been others, but not specifically related to what this office investigates. And that's one of the issues here. So what we know is that there was one case that she felt was founded and that the Ethics Commission, this group of lawmakers, voted to make public. That case had to do with a state senator named Ira Silverstein. He was a Democrat from the north suburbs of Chicago, and he was accused by an activist of having behaved inappropriately towards her, sort of carrying on a flirtatious relationship over digital messages. Ultimately, the inspector general found that he had not engaged in harassment, but had nonetheless engaged in conduct unbecoming. That report was made public by the commission, but their hand was forced because there was a woman, the woman who made the allegations, held news conferences and demanded accountability. And it was really her bringing this attention to light that drew attention to the fact that there was not even a person occupying the office of legislative inspector general. So we know that there was that one case. And then there were a couple other cases that Julie Porter, the outgoing inspector general, said she wanted to publish. One of those was closed by her successor, which has a right to do. But the other one, the Ethics Commission decided, we're not going to publish that case. And that's what prompted her to go public with an op-ed in the Chicago Tribune last week.
All right. Well, we have to take a break here. But when we come back, we're going to just finish up this conversation with Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey. As we've mentioned, we've been talking about this one particular story, the legislative inspector general saying the office is broken. We will tweet out Brian's story. So if you follow us on Twitter at 21STShow, you can see that. But stay tuned. We're going to continue our show live from the Old State Capitol in Springfield just after this short break.
Support comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the School of Art and Design Bachelor of Fine Arts exhibition on view May 4th through May 12th, with an opening night reception at 5 p.m. this Saturday. More at kam.illinois.edu.
Broadcasting live from the Old State Capitol in Springfield in front of a live audience. We're in Representatives Hall. And right now, my guest is Brian Mackey from Illinois Public Radio. And we've been talking about the Legislative Inspector General, Julie Porter. She has been talking about, as her term has ended, that the office is broken. Brian, so if what the person who's supposed to be policing the lawmakers is saying that the office is broken, and this is kind of a repeated, this is, as you were saying just before the break, we've heard this a couple of times, right? Is anyone talking about changing the way the system is?
Well, I mean, she's talking about changing the way the system is.
I guess are the lawmakers who are the ones who have the ability to change it, are they talking about it?
Not yet. I mean, this op-ed came out during their spring break, or as one state senator was pointed to refer to it, their in-district work period, because they're not taking vacation. But this happened during the legislative spring break, so they will be back in town this week. I imagine this will be one of the topics that I and other reporters are asking them about. I did have an opportunity to talk. I tried calling a number of members of this Legislative Ethics Commission last week. They referred questions to their chairwoman, who's a state representative named Avery Bourne, a Republican from Raymond. And she says that, you know, we had a difference of opinion here, and that she's open to further conversations about changes that need to be made. But she also says that there's a reason that the Ethics Commission, there's this sort of balance of power, right? The Inspector General does the investigation, but the Ethics Commission might have a difference of opinion about whether something should be made public. So, and again, this case that she says was buried, we don't know what it was about. We don't know who it was about. We don't know if it was speeding.
We don't know if it was about sexual harassment.
We don't know anything about it, yeah. And I should add one caveat to one thing I said. There is one form of investigation. The legislature did expand the powers of the office last summer in light of the Me Too harassment scandal, and the investigator can open investigations of sexual harassment without permission from the commissioners. But if there's an investigation about bribery or anything else, they still have to get permission from this Legislative Ethics Commission.
And she really seems to think that lawmakers are basically actively thwarting the independence of this office. I mean, in that, I don't know if we haven't really heard very much from lawmakers in response to that other than what you're saying.
I mean, again, I talked to the one woman who is the chairwoman of this commission, and she sort of rejected that. And Julie Porter did say that she was shocked by this happening at the end of her tenure because she had felt supported the rest of the time. But this proves, she says the office really doesn't have any power. It can't punish lawmakers. The only people who can hold legislators accountable are their constituents at an election or their fellow legislators who can choose to do a sort of quasi-impeachment process where they expel them from the General Assembly. That's exceedingly rare. We did see the sort of voting option work. Senator Silverstein, who I mentioned, he wasn't punished within the legislature, but his constituents did reject him at the next primary election. And so maybe lawmakers think that process works okay. But this person who has a strong reputation as a watchdog, was in the job, says, as you said, it's broken.
Well, that's Brian Mackey, IPR State House reporter. Brian, thanks for being with me. It's always nice to chat with you in person.
You too, Nala.
As we're talking about watchdogs, we've been talking about political watchdogs, but there's also journalists who hold people accountable. And that's whether it's Brian Mackey, who we just heard from, or my next guest. Trif Atlatsas is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Sun. Patty Culhane is a correspondent for Al Jazeera, covering the State and Defense Departments. And Natasha Kurecki is a national political correspondent for Politico. They all have long and varied careers, but they have one thing in common. They got their start right here in Illinois and in Springfield through the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. They're in town because tonight these three are being inducted into the program's Hall of Fame. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Congratulations, and thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I wanted to start by asking what you all did when you were here in Springfield. Trif, I start with you. What are some of the first stories you worked on when you were here in Springfield?
Well, I was an intern with United Press International. That's how old I am. And also with Gannett News Service. I covered the Illinois House as an intern and covered folks like Zeke Georgie and a lot of issues coming up there. The governor was Jim Thompson. Jim Edgar was in waiting. And those were kind of the things that we dealt with. I was here in 88, 89.
Okay. Patty, what about you?
Well, actually, the PAR program, for people who don't know, it's pretty unique. It's a short master's degree, but you're also actually, there's only 18 of us. I think it's still only 18. Six go into radio and television, 12 go into print. So you compete to get the internship. So you're actually doing hands-on political reporting. So I started at Channel 20 as an intern, and Dana Perino from Fox News got the number one spot. I was like, great. And then I was in the room when she was named press secretary, and I was like, great, now I'm never going to be the most successful person in our class. That's awesome. No, so I started at Channel 20, got a job producing the morning show, did that for a little bit, and then there was a tornado. I don't remember where, but I remember wanting to be out in the field and said, can't be a producer anymore, I have to be a reporter. So then I moved on.
Natasha, you obviously are a frequent guest of the 21st when we've been talking about Illinois politics. Were you interested in state politics when you first came to Springfield?
I definitely was. I mean, I came from, at the time, I was fresh from University of Illinois in Champaign. I had very little experience aside from the college newspaper. I hadn't gotten an internship before. I felt very behind in my class. And so to walk into the State House for the first time and seeing the legislature discussing, fighting over major issues, I think at the time one of them was an abortion bill, I just remember being this young reporter and being like, my God, I get to cover this? This is so cool. It was really transformative to me. I was hooked ever since.
Trif, I wonder when we think about, I mean, there's so much of a conversation in journalism about State House reporting and how hard it is now. The number of State House reporters tend to be a lot smaller in capitals throughout the country. I wonder, as someone who's now in charge of the Baltimore Sun, how important you think it is for journalists to start out if they're going to do political reporting in a state capital?
I think it's incredibly important. Obviously, there's not enough journalists who are covering state house issues in Baltimore. That's a very important topic for us. We also own the Annapolis Capitol, so these are big issues that affect Maryland. I think if any student can get an opportunity to do what we were all able to do here is really incredible. As Natasha said, being on the floor of the General Assembly and seeing this and the awesome responsibility that comes with it and being around professional journalists who were asking very tough questions is the things you learn, and it carries throughout your career.
So I wanted to ask you, I mean, we often talk about when we think about media in different cities, especially when we're us here in the Midwest, we think of the idea of the coasts dominating a lot of media conversation, but that tends to happen in New York and D.C., not in towns like Baltimore. So I wonder where you see Baltimore and the Baltimore Sun fitting into the media landscape these days.
Yeah, great question. We made a decision several years ago to focus on local news. That news you just can't get anywhere else. Unfortunately, there's not enough journalists on a local level. So in Baltimore, we've made that commitment. We own two other daily newspapers in Maryland, as well as several dozen other publications. And so we've really invested in that journalism. We do have a Washington Bureau because it's so close. There's a long history in Baltimore of our coverage of Washington. But I agree with you. Whenever I visit the reporter in Washington, I am amazed at how many people are in the journalism who are on the floor writing stories from their laptops, and it's amazing at how much coverage is focused on Washington. And certainly there's so much news at the local level, and as we've heard, without that kind of journalism, then that's where corruption tends to breed when there's not enough sunshine.
Sure. If I wanted to ask you, people, I think, have a lot of different perceptions about cities based on what they maybe from national headlines they see. I mean, I certainly think people think this oftentimes about Chicago. What do you want people to know about Baltimore? I mean, I think people here see national stories about when we see national stories about Baltimore. What do you want us to keep in mind?
Yeah, it's a terrific city. Obviously, there's a lot of headlines given what's there are a lot of challenges there, like most big cities. There's a lot happening. Four years ago, there were the riots that right about this time, actually, it was the end of April. And there's been a lot of violent crime that the city's working through. And of late, we did have a FBI and IRS raid last week of the of City Hall and the mayor's homes. So there's a lot of news happening, and we're obviously committed to that coverage, and we get this question often. The Baltimore Sun is charged with highlighting the challenges of the city, but also chronicling the many successes, and it's a terrific city. You should come visit. There's a lot to do there, and you know, our baseball team's trying to come back, but we got a great football team, and there's a lot to do on the harbor, and it's a great waterfront city, and we'd love to have you come.
That's Trif Elatsis, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Baltimore Sun. Patty Culhane is also with us. And Patty, Trif was just talking about Washington. You're based in D.C. as Al Jazeera's English correspondent. You also have reported on wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. How did you first get into war reporting?
A complete accident. Literally,
I don't know, you go from Springfield to war reporting.
Well, yeah. Well, there were a few stops in between. I went, when I decided I wanted to be a reporter, I went up to the Quad Cities, worked for WHBF, and I won't tell you what we said that those stood for, and then moved to Norfolk, Virginia, and I didn't know that it was the world's largest military community, and I'm just a reporter, and then my boss says one day in the meeting, hey, Ted's leaving. He got a job in Dallas. Patty, you're the new military reporter. And I was like, no. I get seasick. I don't like to fly. I have a problem with authority figures. Really bad choice. And he's like, no, it's fine. It's a couple homecomings, a couple deployments. Want to guess what day that was? September 1st.
I was going to say, was it like September 10th?
It was September 1st.
Okay.
Then he says, do you have a passport? I'm like, well, I went to Jamaica once, but I could use my birth certificate. And he's like, yeah, call Senator Warner, get a passport, and I was on a plane to Bahrain. Mm. So, yeah, and I spent every spring for like six years embedded with the Navy or the Marines. But it, you know, I mean, when you say war reporting, now that I work for an international channel, I know war reporting is not the way Americans report. It's like, hi, I've got a whole battalion of men with guns that are going to protect me. A lot of my colleagues, they just go out on their own. And so that's sort of the new bar for me as far as war reporting, but I enjoyed it. And then met my husband while embedded. He was a photographer in Baltimore, and ended up moving to Washington and just got lucky, worked for MSNBC, covered George Bush, moved over to Jazeera, covered Obama, said, I don't want to do this anymore. It's like Groundhog's Day. And so now I'm just a Washington correspondent.
Well, yeah, there's no Groundhog Day involved with that, which I wanted to ask you about, just when you're thinking about how much the news cycle around President Trump or other things that happen in Washington, how much do you think that affects the day-to-day work of federal employees at State and Defense, where you're, the departments you're covering?
You know, the State, for example, the people you talk to are just, they feel rejected. Their morale is horrible. It just, because, you know, the Tillerson came in and he said, oh, we don't need this budget, you know, let's cut the budget. And then now we, federal workers feel rejected. They feel like they're constantly being blamed for everything, that they're just these bureaucrats, but, you know.
And did they feel that way before the shutdown?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I mean, because I don't think so, do you? I think it's a totally different ballgame right now.
Hmm.
Washington is a weird, weird place. I don't know how else to describe it. It's, if you think that it's tense in the heartland, try walking down the street in Washington. I mean, it's just, it's a divided city.
Hmm. That's Patty Culhane, who is an Al Jazeera English correspondent based in D.C., and Natasha Karecki is also with us. Natasha works for Politico, and she now does national reporting for Politico. You're a national political correspondent for Politico based in Chicago. And I wonder, to Patty's point, what it's like to be covering Illinois, covering national politics from the Midwest.
Well, I mean, I think it brings a really good perspective to, I mean, I give political credit for taking a chance on me. And first they hired me to do their, like, a state playbook, which I did every morning here, just Illinois based. But then as 2020 neared, they moved me over to do national reporting, and recognizing that the Midwest is going to be a region that is going to be up for grabs, potentially. Trump stole a lot of those typically blue states from Democrats, and Democrats are going to go hard for Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of activity suddenly in the Midwest, and now the political looks like geniuses. Plus, you know, they're in Washington, and they say, "Wait, Illinois is right by Iowa, right?" And that was the number one question they asked me. Yes, we do border Iowa. So I'm in Iowa a lot. But I think generally just, we have people in Florida and we have people in California. I think just generally it's good to have people who are outside the Beltway who can just bring a different perspective, and, you know, and it helps me too. Like every so often I just try to do checks with just people on the street or other, you know, other moms, other parents, neighbors, just things that we think are so, that we assume everyone knows. Like one question I ask people now in the 2020 race, just people I know, is, do you know who Kamala Harris is? And I can't tell you how many people do not know
people
who she
is. People don't know who she is.
Still do not know who she is.
I mean, there's 20 people. It's a lot of names.
Right,
for,
but I mean,
thinking about Democrats, it's a lot of names for people to bring.
Right. It just helps you realize that, you know, you get so insulated in Washington, and, you know, average people, these are people who are very educated and read every day or involved. They're not, you know, and it's just, it just kind of helps bring a different perspective, I think.
Right, and I guess when you think about, for you, it really, I think, maybe grounds thinking about 2020, right? Because I do think there can be a little bit of a, maybe a feedback loop of journalists and people who think that everyone's paying attention to the 2020 election.
Right, there's that, and then there's also just assumptions on what people are, you know, what people are thinking. And, you know, this is just a typical thing for, you know, news organizations forever, right? You need reporters on the ground who are really talking to real people all the time, so you can say, no, that's not what they're thinking. I mean, one example, they sent me to Iowa a year ago to write about how angry everybody was at Trump because of the tariffs. And, you know, and after talking to everybody, I'm like, they are 100% behind Trump. I mean, Republicans,
yeah, they're not.
Yeah, so it was just the opposite, but it was that, it's that type of that type of thing. You just need people on the ground.
We have to take a break. When we come back, Natasha, I do want to ask you one more question about the Midwest in 2020. But stay tuned. You're listening to a special edition of the 21st Live from Representatives Hall in the Old State Capitol in Springfield. We'll be back just after the break. Broadcasting live from the Old State Capitol and Representatives Hall in Springfield with a great audience. We're here as part of NPR Illinois Public Radio Week. We're grateful to have them. We're kicking off the week helping them as they've got lots of special events this week, including this evening there's an event for the University of Illinois Springfield's Public Affairs Reporting Program, and we've been talking to three journalists who got their start in Springfield who are going to be inducted into the program's Hall of Fame this evening. Triff Alatsis, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Baltimore Sun, Patty Colhane, who is an English correspondent for Al Jazeera in Washington, D.C., and Natasha Korecki, a national political correspondent for Politico based here in Illinois. Natasha, I wonder, as we think about going ahead to 2020, how much you think Illinois, as you're talking about the Midwest becoming a battleground, how much attention are we going to get here in Illinois? Is it going to be focused on people fundraising in Chicago? You know, we're starting to see lots of Democratic candidates coming through to try to fundraise in Chicago, but are we going to see visits other parts of the state as well?
We're going to see a lot of activity, first of all, because it's Illinois will be, you know, depending on who's left still at that point in the primary, we will be the next big primary after
Super Tuesday?
After Super Tuesday, thank you. So you know, whoever's left standing at that point, you know, Illinois will become a big battleground. So I think we're going to see a lot of activity here. Obviously, Chicago's going to be an ATM machine. There's always going to be fundraisers and so forth. But there's also a lot of former Obama people there. The Obama Foundation's based there. So people are coming through just talking to those folks. And, you know, you have Pete Buttigieg.
Is it this week he's going to be in Chicago for a fundraiser?
He was there last week, I think. Okay. He might be back again. He has a Chicago office now. So it's a quick drive for him. So I think he's going to be coming through there all the time. And with Milwaukee now being, with Wisconsin being in play and lots of candidates going to Milwaukee, it's just an easy, like, go to Iowa, go up to Wisconsin, come back down to Illinois. So I think we're just going to see a lot of activity.
Before we go, I want to ask all of you, as you all are being inducted into this Hall of Fame this evening, as you think back on your career, which began right here in Springfield, if you could tell yourself as a journalist just starting out in Springfield and give them one piece of advice, what would it be, Trev?
I would say try everything. Be as diverse as you can in terms of the skills that you can get. Remember, it's a terrific profession, and we need smart, curious people to join it. And you get to ask questions that others can't ask. You get to hold powerful people accountable, and you get to answer for people who can't ask those questions themselves.
Patty?
First, I'd say to young journalists, this too shall pass. One day there will be a president who doesn't think you're the enemy of the people. It is tough out there for journalists right now. I went to one Trump rally, and I can't say on public radio the names that people called me, my fellow Americans. So this too shall pass. But to my younger self, I would say you're going to be afraid all the time, and it's a good thing, because that's something about journalism. It's just the thing you're most afraid of, like, hey, why don't you fly into an aircraft carrier? Sure. And every time I've done something that I'm afraid of, it's gotten me to the next spot and the next step, and I've ended up in a really good place. So be afraid.
Natasha?
I guess I would say stop and take it all in. Anyone who's still in journalism at this point in my career,
Those of us who have survived this long, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're doing it for the love of, you know, the profession. And along the way...
Yeah, we're not doing it
shockingly,
for the money.
Shockingly, no. Not the hours, not the money.
The holidays off.
Right, working in your car, sleeping in, you know, wherever you can and whenever you can. It's not a glorious life, but we choose it. And when you're a young reporter, just, you know, you're going to make mistakes, learn from them, but just kind of enjoy the moment and remember it.
That's Natasha Kerecki, a national political correspondent with Politico. I want to thank Patty Colhane, one of Al Jazeera's English correspondents in Washington, and Trif Atlatsis, editor-in-chief and publisher of the Baltimore Sun. Thanks, guys, for being with me.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dignitaries from all over the world gathered in California to mourn the death of President Richard Nixon. Also in attendance were five living U.S. presidents: Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., and the sitting president at the time, Bill Clinton. It was the first time that many presidents had attended the funeral of another president. And the play, Five Presidents, imagines what it would have been like for these five men to meet. It's the brainchild of Rick Cleveland, who wrote on some of America's most well-known political dramas like The West Wing and House of Cards. And right now, there's a Springfield production of the play that you can catch. It ran last week and will continue this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Phil Funkenbusch directs the Springfield production. He's with me now at the Old State Capitol. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the 21st.
So great to be here.
I'm also joined by two of the five presidents. Ed McMurdo plays President Bill Clinton, and Chuck McHugh plays President Ronald Reagan. Ed, Chuck, thanks for being with me as
well.
Happy
to be here.
So, Phil, can I just start by asking what made you want to direct a Springfield production of this play?
You know, we've done quite a few theater productions at the Lincoln Museum, but I heard about this play when it premiered in 2015 in Milwaukee, and it just sounded like this could be good, and I knew Rick Cleveland was a good writer. So I finally got a hold of the script, and we just decided this could be good for us to do, something different. It's a recent play, and it's got a lot to say.
And it's interesting that it's a recent play, because it's a recent play about something that happened more than 20 years ago. And it begins with Gerald Ford, and then one by one, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Bill Clinton all make their entrances. How would you describe the dynamic between these five men?
It's very interesting because, you know, it's a group of men in one room at the same time, and this is something they usually wouldn't do. But you find out through the play the tensions between some of them, the friendships. At one point, Reagan says, "Well, look at us, you know, here we are, we're all friends and civil with each other." And the play takes you on a little journey, basically because President Ford has decided he doesn't want to give the eulogy.
So let's play a clip from, Ed, your performance of President Clinton. And it's sort of, we're talking a little bit about, to Phil's point about the five of them and the relationship between them. I think this illustrates the idea that he wants to be part of this club of presidents. Again, he's the current president at the time, but he doesn't feel like he's quite there yet.
I'm not saying I had it harder than any of you. I wouldn't dare. I know how hard each and every one of you had it. Jerry had all the Watergate mop up in Vietnam. And Jimmy, you had an unwinnable situation with the hostages in Iran. Then you got hit with the energy crisis. Ron, you had the air traffic controller strike, the assassination attempt, the invasion of Grenada, and Iran-Contra. And George, you had that mess in Panama. Then the Gulf War, and to top it off, a $220 billion deficit. I'm just saying that when someone like Ramzi Youssef and his bunch come along and bomb the World Trade Center, if I'm not mistaken, that was the first attack on U.S. soil since Pearl Harbor. Forgive me, but I thought bringing up these things in this room with only you fellas to hear that I might be met with a sympathetic ear or two, but if I'm wrong about that, then I do apologize.
My God, he talks a lot.
So, Ed, I wonder, this is supposed to be both funny and serious moments in the play, and is it hard to do both without falling into maybe a caricature? I think especially when we think of sort of an SNL version of presidents when we're thinking about people playing presidents.
You can't help it.
You just can't help it. It's almost how we were brought up to see them in a humorous light, is to watch someone do a caricature of them. It is very challenging to not cross that line. Yes, the play is very funny, but I found that what makes the audience, I think, accept us as those men is simply what we're saying. We're not delivering punchline after punchline. You don't hear the rim shot coming. It's just natural conversation and humor that comes out of simply who these men are and who they become when they're with their true peers.
And so, Chuck, you're playing Ronald Reagan. At this point, he's actually about 7 months away. In the time period of the play, this is President Reagan is about 7 months away from announcing that he has Alzheimer's. But I wonder how that affects your portrayal of him.
Well, it actually was his last public appearance before Nancy kind of shielded him from public view. And Rick Cleveland's done a wonderful job of splitting the script, these periods of lucidity that are suddenly punctuated by a moment where you realize that Ronald isn't exactly with us there in the room anymore. But without making him a buffoon, I know that I can hear it in the audience's voices sometimes when Ronald starts to take a little walk off the path, and you can hear people murmuring. You can tell that they kind of feel sorry for him at that point, but then Rick Cleveland's script brings him right back in, and we see the old Gipper, the consummate actor. It's really a fun part to play and very complicated.
I wonder if we can play another piece of the play. And Chuck, this is you as President Reagan talking about the attempt on his life back in 1981.
I didn't even realize that I'd been shot. Not at first. Thought I was just out of breath from all the hustle trying to get me into the limo. The gunfire just sounded like firecrackers. That first bullet got Jim Brady in the forehead. And the second got Officer Delahanty in the neck. One of my body men, Tim McCarthy, he stepped in and took that third bullet for me right in the chest. Fourth shot missed everybody, but the fifth one ricocheted off the car and got me in the chest. The sixth shot missed everybody, too, but that was six shots in less than 10 seconds. I thought I'd maybe cracked a rib or something.
That's a clip from the play Five Presidents, which is being staged right now in Springfield. You can catch it this weekend at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Chuck, so I understand you were actually in the Air Force when you heard the news that someone had tried to kill President Reagan?
That's correct. That was my first day on active duty with the United States Air Force. And for the first couple of weeks of basic training, they keep you sort of sequestered from outside news. But on the very first day, they make you go into the store and buy some of the essential items you need. And I got away from the group and just happened to be near the wall of radios as somebody was there testing out the speakers. And the first words that I heard were that the president may have been hit and that the limo had dashed off to the hospital.
Wow.
So I was the first person in my flight. I had to go spread the word. So unlike most of the flights in basic training, we actually got to sit around the grainy television that night watching the news because our commander-in-chief was in surgery at the time.
So Phil, when we think about this play being written in 2015, how much politics has changed so much since then? We've been talking a lot about politics past and present this whole hour. I wonder, as you think about people in Central Illinois seeing this play in 2019, what you want people to get out of this?
You know, there's a lot. During rehearsals, we would talk about how the things haven't changed as much as we think they might have. But at the same time, my main goal for this play is to have the audience experience it and, you know, think about their own lives and remember some of this history that we've forgotten, really. And the respect that we give to each of these men. I mean, I think it's a very well-written, nonpartisan play, and they each have their moments. I mean, it's very funny, but it's also very serious and sobering, and it's amazing to hear an audience go from a huge laugh into a very sobering moment where you can hear a pin drop. You can hear an audience listen, and that's just something we don't get a lot. And I like to an audience to experience something new that they don't know, a new play. And it's really interesting. These audiences we had this last week were very responsive, and afterwards you could hear them all bringing up these stories that they'd forgotten.
Yeah, well, and I think the idea of listening in politics is always a good idea, especially now. Well, that's Phil Funkenbusch. He's director of Five Presidents, which I said, as I mentioned, is you can catch this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. I want to thank Ed McMurdo, who plays President Bill Clinton, Chuck McHugh, who plays President Ronald Reagan. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Today for our special 21st, as part of NPR Illinois' Public Radio Week, we've been broadcasting from the Old State Capitol from Representatives Hall. Special thanks to Troy Gilmer at the Old State Capitol and to all of our friends at NPR Illinois for hosting us today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to the 21st.